Well, we do have burritos immediately following the service for you. Could you tell? Kind of smells like a restaurant in here. Let's see. You got a pink slip? Why don't we pull that out? And hey, I want to commend you for clapping so enthusiastically when visitors were mentioned. You did pretty good for a smaller group today, okay? You know, when the visitors are announced, it's really, yeah, it's like, oh yeah, really just thrilled to have them here. Oh yeah. That sends the wrong message, so I appreciate your enthusiasm, and we are delighted to have visitors with us today. We're in a series through 1 Samuel, and I'm going to take it into 2 Samuel as well, about the life of David called Becoming a People After God's Heart, because David is the only man who has that legacy, that epitaph, describing him in the entire Bible. So it seems sensible enough that we try to look at some characteristics of what made him such an exceptional person. And today's passage certainly rates near the top, describing his exceptionality. And of course, he makes mistakes, as we will see shortly. But today is certainly one of his finer moments in 1 Samuel chapter 24. As you know, David sort of became a national celebrity overnight, not of his own intention. He just took a bag lunch out to his brothers at the battleground in 1 Samuel 17 and saw Goliath, said, "I'll do it," killed the giant, and overnight, he goes from zero to hero. I mean, he was an unknown in Israel. He came from a shepherding family in a small town named Bethlehem, and now all of a sudden, he's second to the king. And he's so successful in his military exploits, and everyone falls in love with the guy. Jonathan, the king's son, becomes his best friend. He marries the king's daughter, Michal, or Michal. And then, as he's coming back one day from one of these military campaigns, the women are singing a song that has gone to the top of the charts, man. And one of the refrains in this song is, Saul has slain his thousands, but David has tens of thousands. And Saul heard it, and he was angered by it, and he was provoked with a spirit of jealousy. And it says, from that day forward, he always looked at David with an eye filled with jealousy. And once you fall for jealousy or for revenge or for bitterness or anger or whatever, then people's actions tend to confirm your suspicions. It's a funny phenomenon. So from that day forward, Saul sort of loses his mind. He begins to persecute David, tries to kill David. David has to run for his life, leave his family, his home, his wife, everybody. And he runs around in the desert of Judea for years. And you'd think if he just left town, Saul would leave him alone, but that's not enough. Saul was possessed. And so Saul tracks him down all over the desert. And when we get to chapter 24, it's kind of an unusual chapter, because David's in the wilderness of En Gedi, and he's hiding in a cave. And of all the caves, the thousands of caves, and we've seen a little idea of it from our involvement in Afghanistan, that region has huge caves where thousands and thousands of people can hide and gather at a time. And so of all the thousands of caves in Judea, Saul comes into the cave where David is. And because David and his men have been there for a while, their eyes are adjusted to the light, or to the darkness, and they see Saul walk in the front. He can't see them, and David's men go, "Yes, this is great. David, this is the opportunity of a lifetime. Let's stop this nightmare of running all the time. You're supposed to be the king. God says you're going to be the king, and here's your enemy. God sovereignly, providentially brought him and delivered him into your hand. Let's just go over there right now. You can kill him in an instant, and you'll ascend to the throne, and everything's going to be great." What a great opportunity, you know? And especially the fact that they're claiming the sovereignty of God because the circumstances are so out of the ordinary. Which there's a message there, my friends, and that is be careful about using circumstances as affirmation that God is guiding you. I mean, you got to think twice about that because sometimes our carnal interpretations can go into overdrive when something looks like, yeah, this is how I want it to turn out. So really, even though they made it sound super spiritual, it really wasn't God's will that David rise up and smite him. Even though they saw it one way and they said, it's God's timing, it's God's place, it's God's sovereignty, this is God's will, go do it. David saw the situation completely different than the circumstances would have dictated. And he had all the right in the world to go kill this man because the man had treated him, given him evil for good. Everyone supported him in his society. The culture would have accepted it. But he said, no, I'm not going to do that. He said, I'm not going to lower myself to the level of seeking revenge on a personal, a person-to-person basis. I won't do it. And remember, he went up and he cut, apparently Saul set aside his robe for a moment and he cut a little corner off of it. And even that, said his, he was conscience-stricken. He felt bad at the disrespect of cutting the man's out his jacket. I mean, he was a spiritually sensitive man. And even though his men were interpreting the circumstances one way, David had a completely different interpretation. Today I want to talk a little bit about the Sauls in your cave. I talk to you about how to deal with difficult people. Got any difficult people in your life? A show of hands. Any difficult people in your life? More than one. Okay, let's... Yeah. Yeah, they're out there. Doggone it. I want to talk to you about how to cope with some of those bad boys out there. And I wanted to start by reading this great story from Judith Verst. She's written some great children's book. Probably the one she's most famous for is called Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day. If you've never read it, it's a classic. I've quoted it before here. I like children's books for theology. And today is a good example. Here's another one she's written. It's called I'll Fix Anthony. That's the title of the book. In this book, the younger brother is the one complaining about his older brother, Anthony, and what a pain it is to live with him and how Anthony treats him. Listen to this, because I thought it was pretty insightful. He goes, my brother Anthony can read books now, but he won't read any books to me. He plays checkers with his best friend Bruce from his school, but when I want to play, he says, go away or I'll clobber you. I let him wear my Snoopy sweatshirt, but he never lets me borrow his sword. Mom says down deep in his heart, Anthony loves me. Anthony says down deep in his heart, he thinks I stink. Mother says down deep in his heart, where he doesn't even know it yet, Anthony loves me. Anthony says down deep in his heart, where he doesn't know it yet, he still thinks I stink. Here's the turning point. He goes, when I'm six, I'm going to fix Anthony. Anthony will have German measles, and my father will take me to the baseball game. Then Anthony will have the mumps, and my mother will take me to a flower show. Then Anthony will have a virus, and my grandfather's going to take me to the movies. When I'm six, we'll have a skipping contest, and I'll skip faster. We'll have a jumping contest, and I'll jump higher. Then we'll do eeny, meeny, miny, moe, and Anthony will be O-U-T. He'll get Barry M-A-D. When I'm six, I'll float, but Anthony will sink to the bottom. I'll dive off the board, but Anthony will change his mind. I'll breathe in and out when I should, but Anthony will only go glug, glug, glug. When I'm six, I'll be able to tell my left hand from my right hand, but Anthony will be all mixed up. I'll be able to tell time, but Anthony will be all mixed up. I'll be able to tell my street, my city, and sometime my zip code, but Anthony will be all mixed up. If he ever gets lost, I guess I'll go out and find him. When I'm six, my teeth are going to fall out. I'll put them under my bed, and the tooth fairy will come and leave me a bunch of money. Anthony's teeth will never fall out. He'll wiggle and wiggle them, but they won't fall out. I might sell him one of my teeth, but then I might not. Anthony is chasing me out of his playroom right now. He still says, I stink. Anthony is going to clobber me. I have to run now, but I won't have to run when I'm six. When I'm six, then I'm going to fix Anthony. Oh, that was a great story. How many of you can relate to the feelings of Anthony's younger brother? We've all felt that way, you know, about somebody. And if you want to label that feeling described here by Anthony's brother, it would be the word revenge. When I get six, I'm going to get even. My opening paragraph, ever been hurt by somebody? Oh, yeah. Just a few thousand people this week. Sometimes intentionally, sometimes unintentionally. Either way, you get hurt. Unfortunately, when you don't respond correctly to these hurts, they turn into resentments and bitterness. Have you noticed that? Yeah, nurse those babies. That's the scary thing. I've had that happen before, and you start to nurse it, you start to feed it, and it starts to grow. It almost starts to get a life of its own. It can almost take you over. Scary. When we hold on to hurts, they evolve into hates. Resentment may be the number one cause of ruined relationships, just because people can't get over it. Resentment is a gift, the gift that keeps on giving. We need to realize that resenting one person can actually damage our relationship to many other people. The truth is, if you're angry with one person, that anger is flowing out and contaminating your relationship to others as well. That's why resentment is a luxury you simply cannot afford. I think sometimes people use hatred and vengeance and resentment and all that. They feel empowered by it. And initially one might be, but in the long run, it drains us. In today's message, we will see an exceptional example of how we can deal with the difficult people in our lives that hurt and offend us. In other words, if David is a man after God's own heart, he gives us an illustration of how God wants us to respond to difficult people. Certainly would be to our advantage to think about it. We will also discover some secrets for finding release from anger, bitterness, and resentment towards these people. Just think of how wonderful it would be to experience healing from the hurts of the past as well as an emancipation from our animosity towards people who bug us in the present. God help us. Toward this end, we will strive together as we take another step closer to becoming a people after God's own heart. It's interesting, in 1 Corinthians 13:5, Paul the Apostle tells us in the famous love chapter, he tells us that real love, God's love, agape love, keeps no records of wrongs. It doesn't keep a record of wrongs. The little phrase there, keeps no record, is actually an accounting term. It could be translated literally, love does not keep a ledger regarding the wrongs done against it. In other words, it doesn't keep score, it doesn't keep track. And why do you keep track of wrongs? Why would you keep track? Because you're waiting for your chance to settle the score and to get even, basically. That's why we keep records and grudges against people that have offended us, but this tells us we're not supposed to do that. The truth is, though, we often think, he did that to me, doggone it, I'm going to return the favor. Just wait for my opportunity. It's because she did that, I'm doing this. Take that, you deserve it for what you did to me. Or I'm glad you're suffering now because you made me suffer earlier, and we carry on like this. We tend to love movies where at the end the bad guys, you know, they get hammered. Now, I believe in justice. But hatred and bitterness and executing vengeance, this is something that the Bible urges us not to traffic in because it will corrupt and contaminate our own heart, mind, and spirit. And it will impact all of our relationships. I think we think we're so smart. You know, I just hate that person right there. I hate their guts. And I love everybody else, but that person there, you know. And we think we can keep it isolated. The Bible warns us not to think that way. Because it will contaminate, it will leach out into our other relationships. And if for nothing else, just think of the emotional drain of hating that person, that it is annihilating so much positive relational energy that we could be expressing towards other people positively. Hating people is really a dumb thing to do. It's one thing to seek justice. It's another thing altogether to try to get even with people who have hurt us. We often feel justified in our negative reactions towards others because we're keeping track. We're keeping the records. Real love doesn't do that. Real love doesn't play old tapes. Real love isn't constantly hitting the rewind button in order to draw to people's attention their major screw-ups and how much they hurt you. I heard a couple that went to marriage counseling, and the counselor asked the man, he said, what do you think's the matter with your relationship here? And the man said, I just can't stand my wife anymore. She's constantly getting historical with me. And the therapist says, pardon me? Don't you mean hysterical? He goes, no, historical. I mean historical. She never forgets a single mistake I've ever made. I think all of us tend to get historical. We keep records. We think about what people have done wrong to us so that when our opportunity comes, powie. Let's dish out what they've given to us. Look at this warning from Hebrews 12:15. It says, be careful that none of you fails to respond to the grace of God. See, God's grace can give us the ability, because we've been forgiven, to forgive others. It says, don't fail to respond to the grace of God. For the person that does that, what can happen? There can spring up in him a bitter spirit, which can poison the lives of what? Many people. We think, I can keep it isolated, I can control it, I just hate that person's guts, and that's the only ones. No, it's going to create problems. It's going to contaminate and poison your relationships with others. That's why it's so important that we learn how to deal with difficult, irregular people that bruise us, hurt us, abuse us, and not let resentment poison our lives. It's amazing, too, when you start hating somebody, I don't know, maybe it's like the Volkswagen. You know, you buy a Volkswagen, all of a sudden you see Volkswagens everywhere. Have you noticed that? Or you buy a motorcycle or something, and, oh, man, I didn't know they were everywhere. When you hate somebody, it's amazing how omnipresent they become. It seems like they're everywhere in your mind. Everyone reminds you of them. Something you see on TV, a thought crosses your mind, lay in bed at night. You just can't get that person out of your head. There's an old English poem that reads, "He who has 1,000 friends has not a friend to spare, but he who has 1 enemy will meet him everywhere." That's weird, but true. Duke University did a study on happiness. They came up with 9 factors. Here's the number 1 factor for happiness on the overhead. It's the absence of suspicion and resentment towards other people. They discovered that nursing a grudge was a major factor in creating unhappiness in the lives of people. So today, I'm just trying to encourage you. I'm trying to warn you. All of us have a natural tendency to want to hold a grudge and resent people, especially if we feel they've betrayed us. I mean, it's one thing if people, like, you know, people on the freeway and people you don't know act like idiots. It's another thing when someone you love or a family member or a friend or somebody like that betrays you, does a Judas Iscariot, a Benedict Arnold routine, and, you know, stabs you in the back. Man, that is really, really hard to let go. But the Bible urges us to let go, not just for their sake, but primarily for our own sake. And that's why today, if you're struggling with resenting somebody, I want to encourage you to make a decision. You're going to forgive them, even if you don't feel it. I want you to make a decision. I heard the story, I think it was told by Corrie Ten Boom, the woman that came out of the Holocaust. Her family all died. She wasn't Jewish. She was a Christian, but she hid Jewish people. During the war, their family was discovered. The father and mother were killed. Her sister died in a concentration camp. She survived. But afterwards, she really struggled with unforgiveness. But it ended up becoming one of the great messages she carried all over Europe and then eventually brought to the United States. But she said she was struggling once in forgiving somebody and laying awake at night, just the hatred she had for guards and various people. And she said she talked to a monk who told her a story, an illustration that helped her a lot. And it was about ringing the tower bell. And you've seen pictures of how, and, you know, they ring the bell, and they still do that to this day in certain places. And the bigger bells, you've probably seen people can hang on to them, and the sheer weight of it, pull them off the ground, and back down they'll come. Well, this guy said, forgiveness is sort of like the bell. You're ringing the bell. At some point, you have to let go of the rope. That's what forgiveness is. It's making a decision to let go of the rope. Now, he said, just the sheer momentum of the bell, it will continue to ring. You will continue to feel resentment. I've discovered that. I've let go of the rope and still felt, doggone it, you know. You see that person or it comes across your mind. But I have made decisions about people that have hurt me, and I've made the decision. I'm letting go of the rope. I could still hear the bell, but you know what I've discovered over time? Because I made a decision to forgive that person, I decided I was going to do what God told me to, and I knew I couldn't afford the luxury of resentment. The control of it began to diminish and fade in my life. I've actually seen that happen. And I'm so glad that I let those people go. Resentment is the gift that keeps on giving, that's for sure. Now let's talk about it in contemporary terms today. I want to encourage you to let go of the rope. Roman numeral 1, difficult people. We're talking about them. You all raised your hand. You all said they were in your life. Let's talk about the various kinds of them. I'm just going to give you some caricatures, some summations of my classifications of various kinds of difficult people. Can I do that? Can I give you 5 real quickly here? Number 1. This is the first one. It's easy to recognize. The difficult person, number 1, I call the bulldozer. The bulldozer. Okay? There he is. This guy just stepped off his tractor, man, and he's ready to punch you out if you don't do what you're supposed to right now. The bulldozer. Met any of these people at work in your neighborhood? Your brother-in-law. Oh. The truth is, these people all over the place. These are kind of pushy, obnoxious, bully types. They use anger and intimidation to have it their way. They tend to force themselves and their opinion on other people, and they're usually insensitive to our feelings, to other people's feelings. They can be very aggressive and forceful, yelling, pounding desks, screaming, slamming doors, just using their anger, basically, to roll right over the top of other people and to have it their way. They tend to treat people like objects. They have a high need to tell other people what to do and to be in control. I don't know, you can call them the temperament type, the choleric type, the leadership type, the person who's out there. Now, if you want to get along in the world, at some point you have to learn to cope with these people because they're everywhere. I bet you everybody here knows bulldozers. Got them at work, got them wherever. Today's text is actually going to give us some advice about how to specifically do this. But I wanted to mention right here for just a second that, number one, I don't recommend that you fight them on their level. I think that that can be a major, major mistake. To engage the bulldozer with another bulldozer is not usually a very good idea because they kind of like to do it that way. They love to fight. Fighting to a bulldozer is like saying, sick 'em to a pit bull. You know, kind of like, yeah, they love it. Bulldozers are bully. They tend to thrive on fighting. It worked for them when they were 8 in the school play yard. Why not at 48? So that's how it works for them. And you know who I'm talking about. I bet you it comes to mind pretty readily. Now, what we need to do in responding to the bulldozer, in my opinion, is to be assertive, not aggressive. It's to be direct, not demanding. And it's to be confrontational, not combative. I certainly do not recommend passivity in the face of a bulldozer, because they'll just run over you the rest of your life. But I don't encourage, actually, brute force as a response to them either. I don't think that goes where it should go. We need to learn how to look the bulldozer in the eye and simply say, excuse me, but I won't be spoken to or treated that way. We need to say, excuse me, but you're interrupting me. We need to say, excuse me, but your manner of speaking to me is rude and unacceptable. We need to be direct and clear and confrontational without getting into that spirit, that combative bulldozing spirit. I knew a bulldozer once who was trying to intimidate me and to submit to what he wanted me to do, to his demands. And I just didn't think it was the right thing to do. And so he pulled the ultimate trump card on a minister. He goes, and you call yourself a Christian? That's what he said to me. That's supposed to be the ultimate back down line, you know? And I said to him, you bet I'm a Christian, and it's because of that that I don't let people like you push me around. And I wasn't rude. Yeah, Rocky 7 right here. Okay. I wasn't trying to be angry or rude or anything. I'm just trying to be honest because he was actually trying to manipulate me. There was no question about it. And that was sort of like his last stand. And he was a Christian himself. That's why he used that term, see? He'd seen that buzzword go by before. The bully. How about number 2, the sniper? Gotta love the sniper. Now, I want to give you the two sides. This is how the sniper looks on the outside, and the next photo is how the sniper really feels on the inside, okay? But this guy won't show you this side straight up front. You know, this is the person that wishes they were a bulldozer, but because they don't have the position or the power or the nerve or the courage or whatever to just come right out and act that way, at least initially they don't, they manipulate and scheme about how they're going to dare you in or whack you or have it their way or whatever. So even though it appears on the outside that they're being cordial and friendly and cooperative, on the inside the story may be completely different. The truth is they often wait in hiding in order to get a good shot at you. They wait for the right moment, they pop you, and then you're not able to figure out where did that come from, you know? That kind of a deal. They ambush us when we're least expecting it. The sniper is the type of person who throws a snowball at you, but it really hurts because there's a rock inside. You know, and you kind of go, ow, woohoo, that really hurt. And you say it to them because you knew that there was a message in the message. Ever had that? There's a message in the message. So you say, man, that really hurt. And they say, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean that. I was only kidding. Can't you take a joke? It was only a snowball. Gee, you're touchy. Ever had that happen? Something to that effect? And then you're kind of going, I'm getting a little confused here. We're thinking snowball. Yeah, right. I wish that were a snowball, but it hurt like heck. Yeah, I can take a joke. I just didn't think that was really funny. And then they get all defensive. No, I'm just kidding. Hey, Solomon must have had the sniper in mind in Proverbs 26:18 when he said, just as damaging as a man shooting a lethal weapon, just as damaging as a guy just pulling a gun, just as damaging as the bulldozer, is the guy that actually lies to a friend and says, just kidding, I was only joking. You take a joke, haven't you? People use sarcasm and ridicule and they kind of joke about it, but you know there's a message there. You know they're hammering you. You can feel the pain of it. But the minute you say, wait a second, you know, I think I'm getting a double message here. They go, no. They beat this hasty retreat and they say, we're just kidding. Can't you take a joke? Yeah, I can take a joke, but I'm kind of getting confused here. Now, what do you do with a sniper? I think like the bulldozer, you need to honestly and directly talk to a person like this. I think you simply say, I believe you're sending me a double message. Or you can ask, am I hearing you correctly? Because when you say this, I think I'm hearing you actually say this. Or maybe you should just be as blunt as to say, I think what you're saying is actually designed to hurt me. I'm a big advocate of honesty in relationships. And let me just say, this didn't come natural. I'm not a choleric. I'm not the astronaut type. I'm not the colonel in the army. I'm not that kind of a person. I was the third born, last born in my family. My father was an alcoholic. There was just chaos, constantly fighting. I was the fixer in my family. I was the diplomat. I was always trying to make everybody get along. Can't we just do the Rodney King deal? Can't we just all get along? Please? So later in life, whenever there was conflict, I didn't like it. I avoided it. Certainly didn't want to create it, for goodness sakes. But see, bulldozers and snipers and people like this are counting on you being too intimidated, to be honest, because you're afraid of the feelings that may result and the anger or the hostility or whatever. Over the last couple of years, the Lord has really done a work in my life, and I've gotten over a lot of that. And it really helps to get over it, because initially when I first started trying to be more honest with people, it often was inspired by anger. That doesn't always work great, because people get defensive back. They sense, they see it on your face, your body language, the tone of your voice. Doggone, wait a second, you know, what are you so upset about? But I've gotten more objective about it, and I'm more interested just honestly talking to people if I sense something funny is happening. And so I think with the sniper, you just ask honest questions and you ask them about the double message. And when they say, can't you take a joke? You say, yeah, I can take a joke, but I didn't think that was a joke. And I didn't think the joke about it being a joke was a joke either. Try saying that real quick. It's not easy. Now, if they admit it and they say, you know, no, it really wasn't a joke. I am feeling this way. Well, hey, thank God, now you can at least deal with the real problem instead of having these people doing undercover drive-bys on you. Hate those. Or if they continue to deny it and they say, yeah, it was just a joke. Can't you take a joke? At least they now know you're not going to let that behavior go by without challenging it, without asking honest questions about it. And when you start doing that, they'll be a little more reluctant to pull that little routine on you. Do it a few times and the sniper will think twice about doing a drive-by at your expense. They might still talk about you behind your back. But at least their tendency to pester you to your face and call it a joke may cease. Next, we have one of my favorites of all times. And we're going to have a show of hands about which one you are in a minute. But right now, we're going to allow for some anonymity before the shame of it all really breaks in here. It's so funny, too. It's so easy to think about everybody else. Yeah, I know a bunch of bulldozers, those losers. Snipers, yeah. How do we know so much about them? Because I are one, you know what I mean? I'm probably all five of these things at various points and stages in my life. But this one is one of my favorites, and this is the whiner, okay? I like the whiner, man. This is the poor me person. You know, everything's wrong with the world. Everything's bad, out of control. Somebody's always doing something wrong to the whiner, man. He's got no control over his life and circumstances. This is the person that controls by negativity and pessimism. These are the squeakers of the world. They get attention and control others by complaining, criticizing, fault-finding, and looking at the bad in every situation and circumstances. For the whiner, it's bad, 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 doom and gloom constantly. Now listen carefully, because I want you to see the racket and the scam behind this. This is even, the nuance here is even more difficult to capture than the sniper. The sniper's pretty tough to actually expose, get him to admit it. But the whiners can even be tougher. Now, here's the point. Like the two previous difficult people, the bulldozer and the sniper. This person is into power too. But they pursue it in a very different way. They get their power by being powerless. If you didn't know that, this is a big issue. They get their power by being powerless. You know, and I've been a whiner. We've been bulldozers. We've all done these different things. Those who use powerlessness often do it because they feel they have no power over other people. And so they gripe and complain, and they're hopeless and pessimistic about their lives and their situations, and they do it to get power. They can even use sickness and poor health as a source of power and control. They act like their lives and situations are out of control, which simply means, think this through, it simply means that someone else has to take responsibility for them. Therein is the catch. Therein is the con game. What we need to do with the whiners of the world, and I'm including myself in that list, I'm not up here like, oh, you know, that whiner. We all whine at some point. What we need to do with the whiners of the world is empower them to solve their own problems. We need to give them their problems. Whiners want to externalize their problems on everyone else and on the world and on all their bad luck and circumstances. What we need to do is encourage them. We do this by actively listening to them because they need to know that we really care for them and we feel their pain and we're concerned about what they're complaining about. But at some point, when it looks like the person is going nowhere, we need to do something assertive to give them back ownership of their life. We think we're helping people like this. We're not helping them at all. We're enabling them to be disabled. And it's not a good thing at all. And helping them in problem solving, we have to ask questions like, who's responsible for this problem in the first place? What needs to be done? When's it going to be done? How's it going to be done? And who's going to do it? We do this to give whiners ownership of their problems so that they can be empowered to solve them. You know why? Because if you don't, their problems will always be yours and not theirs. That's the way it works. Now, think of it. Is that such a dumb game plan for them to have? I don't think so. I think it's actually pretty bright. These are often very smart, insightful people. Why in the world would a whiner ever want to do the hard work of coming up with their own solution and taking responsibility for their own lives and problems if they can make you responsible? What a deal. Yeah. You know, part of helping people to receive power is give them their problems back. That's part of the deal. Have enough boundaries in your own life not to take on everybody else's needs. Don't be manipulated by whiners. Encourage them to solve their own problems. Number four, difficult person, is what I call the ultra-agreeable, passive-aggressive person. Yeah, yeah. This person is sometimes called a yep hound. A yep hound. What do I mean by a yep hound? They're called yep hounds because they're always going, yep, 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 yep. You say, hey, Bill, can you do this for me? Yep, 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 yep. How about Sally? Can you stay over and do some overtime? Yep, 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 yep. I know that's ridiculous. These are the people that can never say no. So what's wrong with that? I'm looking for people like that. I want to find those codependents, you know, that'll never say no to what I want done, you know? Kind of think, what's bad about that? Wish we could all find more codependents. The fact is, listen carefully, they're rarely as nice as they appear to be. That's because they're passive-aggressive. They often say, yep, 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 but then they fail to follow through and to do the things they said they were going to do, either because, number one, they're overcommitted by saying yes to a million other people, or probably more likely they're actually angry that you're demanding and expecting so doggone much from them. And they don't know how to say no because they're people-pleasers. They want everybody to be happy with them. You know what we do to help these kinds of people? We help them to learn how to say no. Can't do that, and that it's not the end of the world. Usually up front, these people are kind of friendly and nice. We like these people. You got to like the yep hounds. You got to like the, you know, the ultra agreeable folks. You know, you give them a job. I thought we were just like, you know, connecting. But something funny's going on. It can be really confusing when you deal with a passive-aggressive person because they're saying everything they're supposed to say to your face, but the deal's not getting done. Things aren't coming together. There's just something weird that's happening out there. And often, this is the kind of difficult person you're dealing with. We need to empower these ultra-agreeables by encouraging them to share their honest feelings about the fact they feel overwhelmed, or that they feel like if they don't say yes to everybody, they're going to be rejected because not performing good enough. They're often caught up in the whole self, it's, what do we call it? We call it performance-oriented self-esteem. At some point, you go, hey, you know, I don't have to do everything and make everybody happy. Hey, the truth is, if you're trying to make everybody in the world happy, you're going to be one of the most unhappy people on the planet, because it can't be done. Even God can't make everybody happy. Oh, but you, wow, I'm impressed. You can? Wow, that's cool. I don't think so. Last but not least, who do you think the last guy is? Yeah, Mr. Obnoxious, personified. The know-it-all. Don't these guys just buck you? The know-it-alls, don't they bug you? Any smug guy up there, oh yeah, I know everything. Now, this is the smug person who's either two things I'm suggesting. I'm everything, I know I'm being general here. But two things here. He's, number one, either filled with pride at his own exceptionality and grandiosity, which is sometimes, that's really obnoxious. Or the know-it-all may be hiding behind a wall of superiority because in reality they feel inferior. The overachiever, you know, that whole thing, the super competent guy that's got it all, often those guys are just, you know, they're just as insecure as the day is long. Why are know-it-alls so difficult? Well, it's mainly because regardless of whatever motivates them, you know, trying to hang around with them is such a pain because they talk incessantly, they have all the answers, they aren't open to anybody else's opinion. And this behavior is the source of their power and control. They know it all, they want you to know they know it all, and, you know, if they want your opinion, they'll give it to you, basically. It's just real simple. That's the deal. They're the final authority on every subject. They are non-negotiable, always right. Their credo is my way or the highway. And why should they seek your opinion anyway? They already know the answer. So you're sort of irrelevant. Not a whole lot of room for disagreement. You know what's funny? It's called ideological humility. There isn't much of that. You know what's funny too? I'd say even among Christians you can find this. And then when I typed that in, I said, especially among Christians. Christians can sometimes have the personal side of humility down pretty bad. No, please, take my seat, you know. No, you go first. Oh, you have the last piece of cake, all that kind of stuff. But boy, mess with my thoughts. Woo! You know? We're going to duke it out right here, you know. No ideological humility at all. Mess with my ideas, man. And we're going to fight right now. Because I know I'm right. I'm always right. Now, here's the real catch here, and then I'm going to go on. Everybody's wondering, yeah, are we going to get to the passage today, Pastor? I don't know. I'm going to try. Here's the trick. Think about this. Think about the know-it-alls that you've had cross your path. The truth is, if you disagree with anyone who's a know-it-all, they take it as a personal attack. And they react accordingly. That's what makes it so difficult to say anything contrary to the know-it-all. They are so overly identified with their know-it-all persona, you know, or they wouldn't be acting that way, that if you challenge their ideas, they feel like you're attacking them personally. And so, man, it's so hard, it's so difficult to deal with a person like this, and so we feel like we all constantly sort of have to subordinate ourselves just to get along. And so we're not straightforward and honest because we just want to relate to them. Because of their need, we often avoid being direct or disagreeable because it almost always ends up in some kind of big blow-up or confrontation just to be honest or give another perspective. What a drag that is. So how do you deal with this type of person? I think number one, first you have to establish a rapport with them. I think you do that by showing respect for their opinion and what they value. You can't just blow people like this off or you're finished. At the same time, you need to be honest and direct about your feelings and the way you see things. You are a person with an opinion too. You're a person with a perspective too. Two heads are better than one. I believe that both respect and honesty can be achieved in dealing with this type of difficult person. So, on the one hand, you don't have to become angry to make your point. On the other hand, you don't have to diminish yourself into nothingness in order to relate to a person like that. That's my opinion. And here's my last thought on the know-it-all. I believe it's better for you to be who you are, to be honest about what you see and feel, and bring that relationship to an end, than it is to depreciate it, to be depreciated to the point where you're going to withdraw from the relationship anyway. Why not go down in flames? Yeah, be honest with a know-it-all. What you got? What do you got to lose? Nothing. You say, well, it might wreck our relationship. What relationship is that? Parent-child? You know? Master-slave? Yeah. Be gone. Number two, difficult people, a biblical example. I told you I'd get to it. Now, the famous Will Rogers is probably remembered for his most memorable line, and that was, I never met a man I didn't like. The only problem is Will never met my brother-in-law, okay? Strike that from the tape. I was just kidding. You know, we probably think, hey, he never met my boss, my neighbor, one of my coworkers, my brother, my father, my son, my husband. You know? And certainly, we might add on behalf of David, never met King Saul, that's for sure. I don't think he would like King Saul too much. There's no question about it. There are people, irregular, weird people in our lives. Hurt us, speak, say dumb things to us, reject us, damage us. David could certainly relate to the reality of this because he was treated absolutely horribly by a member of his own family, his father-in-law, the father of his best friend, the father of his wife. And suddenly the guy who should be family is trying to kill him, literally. Well, ever since 1 Samuel 18, David's been on the run. We get to chapter 24, and David now is being given a golden opportunity to rid himself of his enemy Saul, shorten the days of his suffering, grab the throne, which God himself had promised he would one day occupy. Sounds reasonable enough to me, but what a difficult test it is. Truth be known, most of us would naturally have tended to react to the situation very differently than David did. But woven into the story, I believe, are principles that will help us respond to the test of difficult people that God allows to come into our lives, whether the bulldozers, snipers, whiners, ultra-agreeable, passive-aggressive, or know-it-alls. Let's read the passage. 1 Samuel 24. I'm going to just read some of the verses. I don't think I'll read the whole chapter, maybe about half of it. After Saul returned from pursuing the Philistines, he was told that David was in the desert of En-Gedi. So Saul took 3,000 chosen men. What do we call them now in Afghanistan? What are those soldiers called? Special forces, thank you. And that's exactly what we're referring to. Think of it, David, the little shepherd kid. You got to get 3,000 guys? We're going to hunt that guy down and we're going to kill him. And so they set out to look for David and his men near the crags of the wild goats. I think David had 400 men. So it's like 3,000 to 400. Now, 1 Samuel 24:3 is pretty funny. It says, as he came to the sheep pens along the way, a cave was there, and Saul went in to relieve himself. That means he went to the men's room. The Living Bible says Saul went into the cave to go to the bathroom. Talk about being literally caught with your pants down. We're told, though, in verse 3, David and his men were far back in the cave. Apparently, their eyes adjusted to the dark. They see Saul come in from the light. He has no idea they're there. And then verse 4, the men said, this is the day the Lord spoke of when he said to you, I will give your enemies into your hand for you to deal with them as you wish. And that got to be enticing. Apparently, there was some prophecy saying David eventually this day would come. They're going, today's that day. You're the man. God's promised you the kingdom. The man's vulnerable, just run over there and let's deal with it. Get it done. Think of it. Of all the caves in the whole wide world, Saul wanders into that one. If you were like into sovereignty and providence and all that, you'd just go, wow, this must be it. This must be the moment. Wouldn't you be tempted to think like David's men? I would. Think, man, the circumstances are with me. That's my heart's desire. Human nature goes into overdrive. Let's just wipe this guy out right now in Jesus' name. Yeah. Verse 5. After David snuck up unnoticed, cut off a corner of Saul's robe. Afterwards, David was conscience stricken for having touched the robe, cut off the corner. He said to his men, the Lord forbid that I should do such a thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, or lift up my hand against him. He is the Lord's anointed. With these words, David rebuked his men and did not follow them to attack Saul. And Saul left the cave and went his way. Then David went out of the cave and called after Saul, "My lord the king." When Saul looked behind him, David bowed down and prostrated himself with his face to the ground. And he said to Saul, "Why do you listen to men who say David is bent on harming you? This day you have seen with your own eyes how the Lord delivered you into my hands in the cave. Some urged me to kill you, but I spared you. I said, I will not lift up my hand against my master because he is the Lord's anointed. See, my father, look at this piece of the robe I have in my hand. I cut the corner of your robe, but I did not kill you. Now understand and recognize that I am not guilty of wrongdoing or rebellion. I have not wronged you, but you are hunting me down to take my life. May the Lord judge between you and me, and may the Lord avenge the wrongs you have done to me, but my hand will never touch you." Wow, what a story. What a demonstration of a man of character. He saw the situation completely in the reverse of what the other men saw. He said, "I'm not going to do it." Three lessons we learn in your notes there, real quickly, A, B, and C. Three lessons from the life of David on how to deal with difficult people. Number one, I want to always encourage you, go against the flow of resentment. And there's a number of ways we can do this. The first is decide you're going to be different. Be different. The men said, this is the day. Look at it in the Living Bible on the overhead. Same verse, 1 Samuel 24:4. They said, now's the time. David's men whispered to him, today's the day the Lord was talking about when he said, I will certainly put Saul into your power to do with as you wish. I mean, wow, wouldn't that be kind of tempting? Just be able to end this in a moment, you know? My life's been miserable for years. This guy's possessed. He's insane. The men knew David was innocent, so they said, carpe diem, even though it wasn't a word in existence at that time. Seize the day. Let's get it done. This guy deserves to die. God sent him in here for you to kill. This is your opportunity. Now, I mentioned this before, and I just want to reiterate this principle that I see immediately in this text as a warning, and that is we need to be very cautious about how we interpret our circumstances, because it's easy to jump to the wrong conclusion rather than seeing God's real purpose behind the circumstances of our lives. Just because you have an opportunity doesn't automatically mean that that's God's will being revealed to you. David's men actually masked their carnality by saying, hey, this is God's will, let's do it. I think people do that. Sometimes they say, God told me, God said to do this. God talked to me, he told me. Are you sure? That's what I say to people. I say, you know, God talking directly to a man, it scares me a little bit. Are you sure? You sure that's true? Yeah, I'm sure God spoke to me. Well, I'm not so sure. Well, let him speak to you about what he wants you to do. Don't let him speak to you about what he wants me to do. That really scares me. In reality, their thinking was veiled carnality, cloaked in spiritual clothing. Yeah, God told you, do it, man. Although David's men, now here's the important pivotal point. Although David's men claim that God providentially brought Saul into the cave to deliver Saul into David's hands, David believed that God brought him into the cave too, but for a totally different reason. God brought him into the cave to see if David was really going to trust God or take the matter into his own hands. Yeah, let's just cut to the chase. I'll just do God's job for him right now. Give me my sword. We whack away. Now, what about you? Now, here's the reason I brought this up. What about you? Do you think there's any Sauls in your cave that have been divinely appointed? No, I just want to kill those people. No, maybe they're there to test your character, build character, teach you lessons about forgiveness, and challenge your personality to move toward Christ-likeness. Remember Jesus being crucified. One of his last words was, Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. The power of forgiveness is always more powerful than the evil of resentment. Here's one of my favorite stories. It's called Building Character. In the northeastern United States, codfish are a big commercial business. Note the following facts. There is a market for eastern cod all over, especially in sections furthest removed from the northeast coastline. But the public demand posed a problem for the shippers. At first, they froze the cod, then shipped them elsewhere, but the freeze took away much of the flavor. So they experimented with shipping them alive in tanks of seawater. But this proved to be even worse. Not only was it more expensive, the cod still lost its flavor and additionally it became soft and mushy. The texture was seriously affected. Finally, some creative person solved the problem in a most innovative manner. The codfish were placed in a tank of water along with their natural enemy, the catfish. From the time the cod left the East Coast until they arrived at their westernmost destination, those ornery catfish chased the cod all over the tank. And you guessed it, when the cod arrived at market, they were as fresh as when they were first caught. There was no less flavor, nor was the texture affected in any way. If anything, it was better than before. They got to tone up a little bit. Now this writer says, each one of us is in a tank of particular and inescapable circumstances. Have you noticed that about your life? It is painful enough to stay in the tank, but in addition to our situation, there are God-appointed catfish to bring sufficient tension that keeps us alive, alert, fresh, depending on God, and growing. It's all part of God's project to shape our character so that we will become more like His Son. Understand why the catfish are in your tank. Understand that they're part of God's method for producing character in your life and in mine. Some catfish in your tank, some Sauls in your cave, just want to eliminate those bad boys. Maybe that's not the best response right now. I don't know. I think I'd leave it in God's hands, because certainly in this story, it was a test of David's character. Did David pass the test? Hello? With flying colors. When he comes out and shows the thing to Saul, Saul breaks down sobbing, saying, "I'm a bad man. I'm so sorry. I've treated you evil for the good you've done to me. Please, I'm going to leave it alone. I'm leaving." And he leaves. He leaves his hardened, bitter heart. Now, the interesting thing was, I wish everyone responded to love that way. Love, acceptance, and forgiveness. But that's not always the case, is it? And it wasn't actually the long-term case here. Later, Saul tried to kill David again. And at this point, Saul even goes kind of, "Come on to the palace and we'll be buddies again." It's kind of interesting. And here's a good warning. Forgiveness doesn't necessarily mean that you have to be reconciled with a person, literally. You follow me? Sometimes that's not a good idea. David said, "Hey, I'm not going to be resentful and bitter. I forgive you. But no, I'm not coming home to live there again." So, I think that's always a good balance. You do not want to necessarily put yourself back in harm's way. David was smart. But David at least knows, everybody says, "Kill the terrible guy." And he goes, "No way. Saul's a man of authority. He's the Lord's anointed. I'm not going to be responsible for mistreating him or harboring resentment, hate, and bitterness in my life. I'm not going to stoop to that level." The wise man of Proverbs confirms David's response on the over. A couple of quick verses. Proverbs 24:29. "Do not say, 'I'll do to him as he has done to me. I'll pay that man back for what he did.'" The Bible says, don't think like that. Don't talk that way. When we do, it means that other people are now determining and controlling my reactions to them. You know, when Jesus said, "If any man strike you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also," what do you think he's really saying there? He's saying, don't let the bad behavior of other people determine how you're going to respond. Don't let people control you. Don't let some idiot who's hurt you control the rest of your life through anger and bitterness. Are you ready for another exciting episode of Who Said That? Here's this week's quote on the overhead. "The last of the human freedoms is to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances." Who said that? A, was it Albert Einstein? B, M. Scott Peck? C, Viktor Frankl? Or D, Dr. David Livingston? Who thinks they know the answer? Raise your hand. Don't shout it out. If you're wrong, you have to be embarrassed publicly. You can't be... Do it anonymously. Just kidding. Anybody have the answer? Anybody think they know who it is? Yes. Are you sure?
Not totally, but all the others.
Is that your final answer? That's the right answer. You can have two free donuts.
Oh, just what I need.
One for you and one for me. No, I'm kidding. Kidding, no. I can't eat donuts right now. No, I'm serious. You do. Viktor Frankl, of course, was a Holocaust survivor. He came up with what's called Logos Therapy, wrote the famous book, Man's Search for Meaning. And you know, one of his classic one-liners is this one right here. He said, "They took everything I had away from me except my right to choose how I was going to respond to them." Isn't that a powerful concept? And that's exactly what Jesus is teaching here. Look at this verse, Proverbs 20:22. "Do not say, 'I'll pay you back for this wrong.' Wait for the Lord. He'll deliver you." In other words, don't take matters into your own hands. Wait for the Lord. David goes, "I'm not going to run off and do this." He'd regret it the rest of his life. That would have haunted him the rest of his life. It would have been a terrible sign. Oh yeah, I'm going to get to the throne God promised me by killing other people just because I hate them. Yeah, that's no way to get there. The minute you take matters into your own hands is the minute God stops acting on your behalf. That's very clear. Look at this verse. This is a serious and profound text. This is a weird text. It says, "Do not gloat when your enemy falls, when he stumbles. Do not let your heart rejoice, or the Lord will see and disapprove and turn his wrath away from him." Is that a weird passage or what? God warns us that if we see our enemy starting to get what he deserves and we rejoice in it and we say, "Yeah, God, stick it to him. Loving it. Love seeing him suffer." He'll actually withdraw his discipline from that person. Why? Because God doesn't want to see your character and attitude ruined by resentment and revenge in the process of seeing justice come to pass. It's actually possible that your attitude of rejoicing in another person's suffering could end up being more reprehensible and offensive to God than that person's original sin against you. That's when I see people being executed, you know, and we have all these big protests and stuff when people face capital. You know, to see people rejoicing at 12:02 because some guy got executed, that's wrong. There's no question about that. That's evil, in my opinion. A Milwaukee Police Department bulletin said this, quote, "If selfish people try to take advantage of you, cross them off your list, but don't try to get even. When you try to get even, you hurt yourself even more than you will ever be able to hurt them." End of quote. And that's for sure. David recognized that spiritual principle, and he goes, "No way. I'm resisting the natural temptation to retaliate. I'm going to be counterintuitive. I'm going to forgive. I'm not going to take it into my own hands." A second principle is B, go against the flow of resentment by being perceptive. Perceptive. Now let me just mention here real quickly a couple of principles. David was perceptive enough, number one, to honor the principle of authority. Saul was the Lord's anointed, for goodness sake. Secondly, he must have perceived to some degree that this was a test for him and the development of his character. Tests go both ways. You can flunk them or pass them. He could have taken matters in his own hands, flunked the test. Instead, he goes, "No way, I'm not going to do it." And thirdly, he may have recognized a principle that I simply describe as hurt people, hurt people. And sometimes we have to be big enough in the love of God to see beyond somebody's obnoxious behavior to a hurtingness in their own life and to love them beyond that point of brokenness. Not always. Some people are just plain dangerous and you need to distance yourself from them. But other people can be healed if we don't simply react in anger or get vengeful. Carol and I were flying back from Honolulu once to San Francisco. I swear, it's the weirdest story. Carol sits by the window. I sit in the middle. A lady comes and sits next to me. You know, I'm just being friendly there on the tarmac before we pushed away from the gate. I turn to her and I go, "Hi, my name's Eric." She looks at me with a big scowl on her face. She goes, "Good for you." Just like that, I'm not kidding. I'm like, I scream, "Stewardess, help me. We need new seats." Wow. That was one of the weirder experiences I've ever had. I mean, like, what do you think? Do you think that lady was a little bit of a hurting person? Somebody should have been whacking on her somewhere. I don't know what she thinks I was going to do. Wow. Be a little perceptive. What? It was a tense flight. Let's just leave it there, okay? Acts 7:52, Stephen, being stoned, cried out. "Father." I just check every now and then. Randy's one of the best technicians I have. Let's give Randy Samita a hand. Wow. Really, Randy and the team go the extra mile. I'm taking you guys all out to dinner here soon. Not you guys, the technicians who spend nights and days down here getting ready for this stuff. "Father, do not hold this sin against him." Where did he learn to say something like that? Yeah, from Jesus. That was David's perspective towards Saul. Listen to this quote. "How does the Lord look at the person who abuses you? The Lord looks at that person as a very precious, though fallen, part of his creation. He looks at that person as being potentially redeemable. one who can eventually be transformed into the image of Christ. And the one who has misused you, God sees a possible adornment for heaven, someone who could be to the praise of God's glory throughout all eternity before watching, wondering myriads of angels. End of quote. That's a great quote, huh? Now listen to this. This is what makes this so interesting. Remember when Stephen's being stoned? Remember the guy holding all the jackets for the guys that were killing him? What was his name? Saul. Isn't that kind of weird? Saul was his name. And who did Saul later become? The Apostle Paul. I remember hearing a Southern Baptist preacher once preaching, and he said, it was the blood of Stephen that impressed Paul with the blood of Jesus. That was a great line. People are watching us. If we're going to ever become, if we're ever going to become a people after God's own heart, we must cultivate the skill of seeing people, especially difficult people, as God sees them. Okay, I'm out of time. C, go against the flow of resentment. B, what? What do you think the last word is? Starts with an F. Forgiving. That's the bottom line. Be different, be perceptive, and ultimately be forgiving. Let it go. David said, I spared you. David thought, if I can show Saul I'm his friend, I don't harbor resentment towards him, I don't want to hurt him, it'll change his heart and mind. And in his case, it worked. It touched him. See, the truth is, he knew that if you fight the fire of resentment with the fire of resentment, it just builds a bigger fire. Saul called back, is that really you, my son David? On the overhead, I'll give it to you in the Living Bible. Then he began to cry, and he said to David, you are a better man than I am, for you have repaid me good for evil. Yes, you have wonderfully been kind to me today, for the Lord delivered me into your hand, and you didn't kill me. Who else in all the world would let his enemy get away when he had him in his power? May the Lord reward you well and for the kindness you have shown me today. It melted his heart. Excuse me. Now, we have to remember that people who are difficult and obnoxious are often starving for genuine love and forgiveness. Now, I can't promise that what happened here to David and Saul will be the result of every situation you're dealing with difficult people just because you refuse to resent them. But even if they don't change, at least they're not changing you. You follow me? Elie Wiesel, the Holocaust survivor and great writer, said this. It's an old tale he told. A just man came to Sodom hoping to save the city. He pickets, he protests. What else can he do? He goes from street to street, marketplace to marketplace, shouting, men and women, repent. What you're doing is wrong. It will kill you. It will destroy you. They laugh at him. He goes on shouting until one day a child stops him and says, poor stranger, don't you see that everything you're doing is useless? No one will listen to you. Yes, the man replies. Then why do you go on? The child asked. He said, I was convinced that I would change them at first. Now I go on shouting because I don't want them to change me. End of quote. If nothing else, forgiveness protects us from becoming like our enemies. Time's up. Roman numeral 3, a difficult people, a personal application. Last passage here. This is as succinct as it gets. New Testament, often you get the stories in the Old Testament. The New Testament will just say it. Here it is. Here's the commandment we must obey. Paul said, do not take revenge, my friends, but leave room for God's wrath. For it is written, it is mine to avenge, I will repay, says the Lord. On the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink. In doing this, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but do what? Overcome evil with good. Four quick points in closing. A, number one, realize your difficult people are Heavenly Father filtered. That means God has a purpose for the Sauls in your cave, for the catfish in your tank, for those weird irregular people that are always bugging you. Number two, B, realize that God uses difficult people to develop our character. In James 1, verses 2, 3, and 4, in the Phillips translation, it says, when all kinds of trials and temptations crowd into your lives, my brothers, don't resent them as intruders, but welcome them as friends, because they come to test your faith and to produce in you the quality of endurance. Okay, so God's doing something. See, realize that evil never overcomes evil. When you try to overcome evil with evil, you're actually going to be overcome by evil, because two wrongs never make a right. The Bible teaches that if we repay evil with evil, we will become a victim of the very thing we're trying to fight. It's nuts. We'll become an evil doer too. That's why we don't want to let resentment, bitterness, and unforgiveness make us a victim of evils too. So we overcome evil with good, and we use God as our example. That's why in the Lord's Prayer we say, forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. Critics will say, if you do that, you'll become a doormat. Everybody will just walk on you. Is that what God's word teaches us? No. G.K. Chesterton was right when he said, Christianity has not been tried and found wanting. It has been found difficult and never tried. Hey, I think this is a better approach. And finally, last but not least, let's remember that we are all the difficult people in other people's lives. Seems fair to close with that, isn't it? Isn't it so easy? Can't you just find everybody? You know, it's so funny here. It's easy to identify others around us as falling into one of these difficult people categories. Oh, yeah, I know that bulldozer guy. That sniper? Yeah, he's one of my coworkers. He's a jerk. A whiner? Yeah, my sister-in-law? Yeah, he's terrible. Passive-aggressive? Yeah, I know some people. I can never figure them out. Or, you know, the know-it-all? Yeah, we know all these people. Let's never forget the words of that great theologian Pogo who said, we've met the enemy, and it's us. Ah! Let's have a show of hands. How many people here are bulldozers? Just kidding. Whiners? Snipers? Passive-aggressive? That's not too shameful. Yeah, passive-aggressive, that's okay. All right. Okay, that's not too bad. How many know-it-alls? Know-it-alls. Are you proud of it? Let's see. Right here. Okay. A couple of know-it-alls. We're proud of it. Okay. It's not just, remember that old song, it's not my brother, it's not my sister, but it's me, oh Lord, standing in the need of prayer. I mean, at some point, let's try not to be the difficult people in other people's lives, for goodness sake. There's enough of those bad boys out there to fill their cave. You don't have to help out. Let's pray and ask God to help us to see that He's working in our lives through difficult people. Let's ask Him to help us to forgive those that have sinned against us. Even though it's irrational, even though it's counterintuitive, Ephesians 4:32 tells us we should forgive others as God in Christ has forgiven us. And let's ask God to help us not to be difficult people in other people's lives. That seems reasonable today, doesn't it? Now, Lord, I know that all of us can immediately identify people that have hurt us in the past, people that we may still struggle not to hate and resent and feel vindictive toward, people that we never want to see again. Lord, I just pray that we'll let go of the rope today. We make a decision to forgive those people. We're not going to let bitterness and resentment and unforgiveness pollute and contaminate our heart, our spirit, our mind, our relationship with You. Your word says that if we don't forgive others, You won't forgive us. So we make the choice today to let those people go. And for those that are currently in our lives that are creating problems for us, Lord, give us grace and discernment. Help us to see it from Your point of view. Help us to know how to approach them with wisdom. And Lord, if we're being obnoxious in some capacity toward others, help us to soften. Help us to lighten up a little bit. Help us to be Your people. Help us to follow David's example and become men and women after Your own heart, I pray in Jesus' name. Amen. 12:30, we're stopping right on time today. God bless you. As always, you can receive prayer about something that this message may have spoken to your heart about, or about any need you might have. Don't hesitate. These people have good faith and would love to minister to you today. The Lord bless you. You're dismissed.